This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Big news! One generous Marketplace fan, Dr. Joe Rush from Florida, is offering to match the next $50,000 in donations to Marketplace. And every single gift gets us closer to a critically important May fundraising goal. So please, give right now and double your impact thanks to this generous match. Go to marketplace.org/donate. Look, these things happen. It's normal but unnerving. We get that. So today, why they happen and what it means. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, today the 27th of February. Good, as always, to have you along, everybody. Well, here we are, right? Day four of honestly who knows how many days of big, scary coronavirus-induced drops in the stock market. Another 1,200 points down on the Dow today, 4.5%. 4.5% on the S&P 500 as well. It's jarring, I know, but context being everything, 2 points here. One, the economy, which, as we know, is not the Dow, is at this moment strong. And two, painful though weeks like this may be, these kinds of drops, corrections they're called, are actually normal and good. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore gets us going.
Technically, there's no official definition of a correction, but most people will tell you it's a fall of 10% or more from a high.
A correction basically can arise literally out of the blue.
John Bollinger is president of Bollinger Capital Management.
Some corrections can be predicted. There are hints out there. For example, in this correction, there was a lot of fear building up about the coronavirus.
Now, the fact that we call them corrections suggests that something needed to be corrected, and sometimes it did.
Excessive optimism, calm and complacency.
Jim Paulson is chief investment strategist at the Luthold Group.
It becomes too easy to make money for a while. And as a result of that, investors give up the scrutiny of fundamentals and just buy something because it's simply going up and they don't want to miss out.
Corrections can clear out that kind of buzzed buying and make people pay closer attention to the underlying health of companies. It can also shake things up. For example, if everyone is piled on like lemmings to a few tech stocks, it can shake some investors off and a different group of stocks can become the popular ones. As for what to do when one comes along, here's Andrew Karoly, professor of finance at Cornell.
For the average investor out there, the first instinctive reaction I always recommend is to stay calm. And try to understand it, listen to the market experts, but not necessarily to react, and certainly not to react quickly.
Maybe just wait for it to pass. They always do, eventually. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Eventually, yes, but we are stuck in the now. And Goldman Sachs had a rather foreboding prediction this morning. Companies in the S&P 500, Goldman says, might not see any earnings growth at all this year. To be clear, that does not mean they are not going to be making any money this year, just that they will be making the same kind of profits they did as last year on average. Marketplace's Mariel Segarra looks at what that might mean.
Let's get something out of the way. Why do we care about profit growth? So what if companies are only making as much money as they did last year? Gus Fauché, chief economist at PNC, says that growth is really important.
If we don't see increases in profitability, then we don't see expansion efforts. So we don't see businesses building new facilities. We don't see businesses hiring more workers. We wouldn't see rising wages.
But there's always a but. If corporate profits are the same this year because of the COVID-19 outbreak, that's not necessarily a huge problem. Scott Yonker teaches finance at Cornell.
To be honest, 1 year of flat earnings growth doesn't matter a whole lot.
1 year can be a blip. It doesn't necessarily mean the U.S. is headed for a recession. Profits were basically flat in 2012, and the economy still expanded. Also, flat isn't so bad. Yonker says you need to worry when profits are dropping by a lot.
It's when you have big negative earnings growth that things matter. So in 07, 08, right, that was the financial crisis. We saw, you know, earnings decline by 40%.
And remember that this Goldman Sachs estimate is an average. Here's Gus Poche again.
The effects are going to be unevenly distributed across the economy.
Some companies' profits might fall in industries like travel and retail and energy, and some might go up. I'm Mary Elstiguera for Marketplace.
All right, last doom and gloom thing here before a quick up note. Bank of America analysts said this morning global economic growth, so that's not corporate growth that Marielle was talking about, but the whole global economy is going to grow at a relatively subdued 2.8% this year. That is the slowest rate for global growth since the financial crisis. So that. Now, though, for a slightly more promising item, Starbucks said today that it has reopened 85% of its 4,000 or so stores in China. Might remember a month, maybe what, 5-6 weeks ago, news that Starbucks was closing those stores was one of the big uh-oh moments for us. On Wall Street today, smart money on the Wawas when we do the numbers. We've been bringing you stories this week of the American labor force, not with a sampling method data scientists would be happy with, to be sure, but 9 stories so far, 9 people and their jobs that we are using as stand-ins for the 164 million of us the Bureau of Labor Statistics calls the American labor force. We're doing it because while these are the people who make this economy work, one wonders whether this economy is working for them. This is the United States of Work.
There's always things that you don't like about your job.
You work hard for what you want.
You know, every job has your ups and downs.
Whatever good job means.
I like the hustle. I like working fast.
That's not a career. It's a lifestyle.
Before I introduce you to the 10th person in our reimagining of the American labor force, an observation. A pretty obvious one, perhaps, but the jobs or job that you land in depends a whole lot on the kind of education and training you are able to get. Community colleges and technical schools play a big part in that. Places like, Minneapolis College in the Twin Cities, which offers liberal arts degrees, business, and nursing programs. Also,
we're kicking off the first program in the nation on bicycle repair, which Minneapolis is known for its bicycle-friendly environment. We continually compete with Portland for that title.
I would have thought Portland would have had the edge just because weather up there is so rough, but maybe that's just me.
Yeah, they got some fat tired bikes that get students to campus even in the worst of snowstorms.
That's Derek Lindstrom. He's the dean of the School of Liberal Arts and Cultures at Minneapolis College. The BLS characterizes his job as management, professional, and related occupations. 4 out of 10 of us have that kind of job. It is the biggest category. In our series, it includes Michael Durant, our CPA in New York, Dr. Scott Anzalone in Ohio, and Stephanie Silverman at the Belcourt Theater in Nashville. But back to Derek Lindstrom. He is 40 years old. He's married with 2 kids. He used to teach communications studies. Now with a doctorate in higher education administration, though, he's doing something else.
Well, I think my main job is to support faculty so they can provide exceptional educational experiences for our students. I supervise over 100 faculty members, beginning from American studies all the way to women's studies. I have world languages, history, philosophy, communication studies. And so part of my work is putting together a schedule that allows students to successfully move through the college over the course of their academic career here, thinking about staffing levels, a lot of spreadsheets. My former faculty colleagues joke that they knew I was going to be a dean because I liked spreadsheets.
Which is not something you think of when you think of academics.
It's not. There's a part of the institution that needs to operationalize learning, and that's my role.
Is this something you wanted to do when you were a kid?
No. Not because it's not valuable, but my dad was a laborer on the railroad, and I'm a first-generation college student, and so my understanding of education was you went to college to get a good job, in parentheses, whatever good job means. I knew that if you went to law school, you could be a lawyer. If you went to med school, you could be a doctor. But that was the extent of my exposure to higher education, except for Beverly Hills 90210 or anything that we might be a popular culture reference, right? Cal State University. Not to make light of it, but
no, of course.
That's a pretty common experience for most of our students at Minneapolis College as well. You know you need to go there, but you don't really have the background to know to what, mm-hmm. what's going on, even thinking about the different ways in which my kids will experience higher ed is way different because they have both myself and Christina to be wayfinders for them.
Christina, your wife, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's pretty much a given then that your kids are going to go to college, right? Is that an option?
Yeah, that's an option. What that may play out and what that looks like is dependent on their interests and abilities. It's kind of funny. My 11-year-old has it in his head that he's going to go to Harvard. I don't know where that came from. but he's got it locked in. He told me the other day, "Hey, Dad, did you know only 5% of applicants make it to Harvard?"
5% in a good year, man. You kidding me?
Yeah, I know, right?
Right?
Like, so what world problems are you going to solve before you apply?
Yeah.
But
does this job put you in a pretty good place financially in the Twin Cities? I mean, you get by, right? Can you take the kids on vacation? You got to pay for the house and a couple of cars?
Yeah, it's provided for a good life for my family. It provided us an opportunity to take my in-laws in when my father-in-law was diagnosed with vascular dementia. I mean, if they want to give me a pay raise, I'll take it, but I'm not going to complain.
What would happen though if this job went away tomorrow?
Well, timing would be really difficult, being that in the last week, the public school district that my wife works in eliminated all of their librarians in a move that's been part of a larger budget cuts to the school district. And so if it went away tomorrow, it would be problematic because we'd have two people on the marketplace for jobs. If I were the only one looking for a job in the household, it would be difficult, but there would still be some opportunities to move laterally or getting back mm-hmm. into the classroom as well.
Yeah, it's interesting. You've got a trade, right? You've got a skill. You can teach.
Yeah, that's correct.
And you can work spreadsheets too.
I can work spreadsheets too.
Sometime before the end of the year, I'm going to go up and visit with Derek, maybe learn a bit more about that bike program. Don't know. Same thing, by the way, for everybody else that you have met over the past week or so. I'm going to go spend a day or two, talk to them about the work that they do and whether this economy is working for them. If somehow you missed our interviews the last couple of weeks, or you want to read more about this project and how we did it, check our website, marketplace.org/work. More about the United States of Work on the program tomorrow. Coming up.
At risk, root cause, optics, you can probably fill in the rest.
The corporate buzzwords we love to hate, but first, let's do the numbers. Okay, deep breath here, peeps. Dow Industrials off 1,190 points, 4.4%, 25,766. The NASDAQ down 414 points, 4.6%, 85.66. The S&P 500 lost 137 points, 4.4% there as well, 29.78. Microsoft weakened 7% today. Questions about disruptions to its supply chain. Coronavirus, thank you very much. HP and Apple, same. HP off 3.6%. Apple
down 6.5% today. Bank of America dropped 4.8%. You heard its global growth forecast, right? Citigroup rushed down 5.4% today. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note, record lows, 1.27%. Money in this economy, basically free. You're listening to Marketplace. Big news. One generous Marketplace fan, Dr. Joe Rush from Florida, is offering to match the next $50,000 in donations to Marketplace. And every single gift gets us closer to a critically important May fundraising goal. So please give right now and double your impact thanks to this generous match. Go to marketplace.org/donate.
My name is Lee Hawkins. I've been a journalist for over 25 years. On my new podcast, What Happened in Alabama, I get answers to some of the hardest questions about how things came to be for many Black Americans and the truth that must come before any reconciliation can happen. I investigate my family history, my upbringing in Minnesota, and my father's painful nightmares about growing up in Alabama. What Happened in Alabama is a new series confronting the cycles of trauma for myself, my family, and for many Black Americans. Listen now.
Hey, y'all. I'm Rima Reis, host of Marketplace's podcast, This is Uncomfortable. On this week's episode, I, along with a couple of guests, help answer sticky listener questions around money, like whether you should share your salary with friends or how to not feel guilty for treating yourself.
There's a lot of work we all have to do about convincing ourselves that what we want is okay, and what we want might not be what our parents want. But at a certain point, you're grown and you just like what you like.
New episode every Thursday. You can listen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. A lot of the decisions the federal government's eventually going to have to make about COVID-19, the medical decisions, to be clear, are based on data that comes from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And that data is based on information that comes funneled through the CDC's Emergency Operations Center. Sam Whitehead from WABE in Atlanta got a look inside.
On the main floor of the CDC's Emergency Operations Center is its mission control. Public health workers sit side by side in long rows, some huddled together to confer over data. Officials gather inside conference rooms for strategy sessions. Giant monitors display charts and maps with up-to-date information on the COVID-19 outbreak. For such a busy place, it's kind of quiet.
It can be deceptively quiet sometimes.
Dr. Jay Butler is Deputy Director for Infectious Diseases at the CDC, who led a recent press tour. He thinks of this facility as a kind of emergency room, where critical problems, instead of patients, get triaged.
Maybe we can consider this the ER of public health. So even though at any given moment it may be quiet, there's times when it's quite hectic.
The EOC is always staffed around the clock, but activity picks up during events such as the COVID-19 outbreak. The CDC says it has about 1,000 people working on the response globally. Some have been pulled off their regular day jobs to pitch in. Butler says different parts of the agency started watching the disease after it emerged in China late last year. There's a team tracking cases, one developing and running diagnostic tests, yet another looking at the best treatments. Eventually, the CDC decided to bring those groups together here.
Of course, this is government, so there's a structure to what we do here, although our goal is to get outside of our bureaucratic silos and be able to communicate.
Butler says the idea is to help people make quick decisions about deploying resources. The agency's budget for public health preparedness and response is $850 million in the current fiscal year. There's also $85 million in an infectious disease rapid response fund. Butler and others at the CDC declined to say how much it costs to run the Emergency Operations Center or how much it's invested in the COVID-19 response.
We try to be good stewards with the public funding, but also recognizing that money should not be the issue primarily when we're talking about the health of Americans.
A big part of the government's response is carried out at the local level. That's why Dr. Marcus Plesha has spent the last few weeks working in the EOC.
I'm there for maybe a half a day in the morning.
He's chief medical officer with the Association of State and Territorial Health Officials. PlushUp helps the CDC coordinate with local public health departments that want to make sure they're following the agency's recommendations.
Often it's a request, hey, we need some formal guidance on this. Can you give us something that we know is science-based and we know that is going to be used uniformly across many different communities?
PlushUp points out this is a new disease. Public health officials are still learning about it. And already there is some disinformation about COVID-19. And the EOC Brain Trust relies on partners outside the CDC to help dispel it, like the American Public Health Association. Dr. Georges Benjamin is with the group. He says those kinds of rumors can make an outbreak worse. He says his organization routinely amplifies CDC recommendations through social media and its public health members to make sure the best information gets out to the public.
You only really get a few times to make sure that they're getting the right information. And so getting that information out there correctly as quickly as possible is very, very important.
This week, the CDC has started putting out more details about how Americans should prepare for a significant disruption of their daily lives in the event COVID-19 starts to spread widely through their communities. In Atlanta, I'm Sam Whitehead for Marketplace.
The big challenge of the coronavirus so far is something called a supply shock, the idea that manufacturers can't make enough of whatever they make to supply the market. We saw that with Apple and its revenue warning a week or two ago. Microsoft, as I mentioned in the numbers, it makes software that is pre-installed in computers made in China, right? It's warned sales are going to fall. Big manufacturers in Korea, Samsung among them, now say their supply chain problems are going to hit output as well. What's going on here is a global manufacturing model that focuses on low costs and lean inventory at every step in the process. A model heretofore widely praised where all the parts arrive at the plant just in time. Marketplace's Scott Tong reports now on what we have learned about the just-in-time model and whether the pain this time might change things.
The just-in-time model comes from Toyota, which in the 70s started having car parts arrive at the plant at the moment of assembly. Economist Adam Slater is with Oxford Economics.
You try to organize your delivery of them so that they arrive just as you need them. The final product goes out, and then you get a new set of inputs coming in just when they're needed for the next product to go out.
It became global manufacturing gospel. Thing is, the quest for leanness and cost-cutting led many companies to put all their eggs in one supplier in one country, and they got burned when some disaster hit, say an earthquake or a pandemic. Barry Lin is executive director of the Open Markets Institute.
Back then, something went wrong. Toyota went down, but every other company continued to manufacture cars. Today, if something happens, if one of those suppliers goes down, all the companies go down.
That happened in the car business 9 years ago when the tsunami hit Japan. Now it's electronics and China's coronavirus. Supply chain economist Susan Helper at Case Western Reserve says manufacturers have tried to build in safeguards, but there's a lot of cost-cutting inertia to overcome.
Purchasing managers are really intensely measured on how low their costs are. So that doesn't leave a lot of room to kind of spend extra money because there might be some contingency in which everything falls apart.
This time around, she thinks the pain of over-reliance on Chinese suppliers could speed up change. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
You use them, I use them, even though we know better, right? Buzzwords, lingo, shorthand, words and phrases like low-hanging fruit, monetize. I hate that one, even though, yes, I know, we got to monetize stuff. Also, my particular non-favorite, going forward. Olga Kazan wrote in The Atlantic the other day about buzzwords, corporate and otherwise, and why they bug us so much. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So those were mine. What did you get when you reached out on Twitter? What do people really hate?
People really hate capacity, at risk when you're talking about people, root cause, optics. You can probably fill in the rest.
Yeah, for sure. It's crazy. Everybody's got their list. Why do these words bug us so much? Because, lordy, they do.
Well, there's like a couple different theories, right? One of them is just that they're annoying because we kind of find the tasks that are associated with them annoying. So circling back and touching base is kind of interlinked with having to, you know, follow up on some tedious thing that you really don't want to be thinking about anymore, but nevertheless, you have to track down. So it's sort of just linked in your mind with these annoying business tasks.
Are we protecting ourselves? Is that kind of what's going on here?
Yeah. So in some cases, you know, they're kind of useful when you're trying to make something sound a little bit better than it actually is. So things like, you know, optics sounds better than like this might look bad otherwise,
for sure.
You know. So in some cases, yeah, you're kind of dressing up something that otherwise is a little bit unseemly.
So there is a line in here, and let me see if I can find it. It's the fact that so many people rely on buzzwords suggests that work and its language is a kind of pretense, and speaking the language of work reminds people that they are pretending, which reminded me of something RuPaul said to me on this program. He said, "Oh, honey, everything is drag, right? So we're just dressing it up."
Yeah, sort of. I mean, so one of the researchers, the way they put it to me is that, you know, it's sort of like pretending to be an adult. And mm-hmm. so you're using these words that you normally wouldn't use. You would never, you know, they're not real words, but you're kind of at work. You're pretending to be an adult. And so you're saying things like root cause and growth hacking, you know, because you feel like you should.
So we're just not going to stop, right? Because it's a mechanism for us.
Yeah, I mean, it can be useful for some people, especially, you know, if you need to relate to someone in your same office and you can, it's kind of a shorthand in some cases. It obviously makes you look good to the boss if you speak the language that your boss made up for you to speak. So, you know, most people are probably going to continue using these even as they find them a little bit annoying.
We certainly will. All right, hit me up on Twitter. I'm at Kai Rizdal. Tell me what you hate to hear and we'll give you another list maybe in a couple of days. Olga Hazan writing in The Atlantic about the buzzwords we love and hate all at the same time. Olga, thanks a lot.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on.
This final note on the way out today, example 3,742, I think it is, of brands not quite being on the ball. Constellation Brands, parent company of, among other things, Corona Beer. And I bet you can guess where this is going, yeah? Anyway, Constellation, which owns Corona, is spending $40 million launching a new product, Corona Hard Seltzer, which they started promoting just this week on social media, which is where I saw it. A tweet, cans of Corona Seltzer, and in big block letters, coming ashore soon. A company spokeswoman emailed CNBC, and this is a quote, "While we empathize with those who have been impacted by this virus, our consumers by and large understand there is no linkage between the virus and our business," which is true, but come on. All right, we got to go. Dow Industrials off 1,190 points today, 4.4%. NASDAQ down 414 points, 4.6% there. The S&P 500, 137 points on the downside, 4.4% there as well. Amir Bibawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, and John Gordon are the Marketplace editing staff. Betsy Streisand is the managing editor. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Khreis, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.